broke into a wide smile. "Our nigger's back," he said. The summer Sean and I had worked the shear, there'd been an afternoon when I'd wiped the sweat from my face so many times that, by the time we quit for supper, my nose and cheeks had been black. That was the first time Sean called me nigger. The word was surprising, but not unfamiliar. I'd heard Dad use it, so in one sense, I knew what it meant. But in another sense, I didn't understand it as meaning anything at all. I'd only ever seen one black person, a little girl, the adoptive daughter of a family at church. Dad obviously hadn't meant her. Sean had called me nigger that entire summer.
"Nigger, run and fetch those C-clamps." Or, "It's time for lunch, nigger."
It had never given me a moment's pause. Then the world had turned upside down. I had entered a university where I'd wandered into an auditorium and listened, eyes wide, mind buzzing, to lectures on American history. The professor was Dr. Richard Kimball, and he had a resonant, contemplative voice. I knew about slavery. I'd heard Dad talk about it, and I'd read about it in Dad's favorite book on the American founding. I had read that slaves in colonial times were happier and more free than their masters because the masters were burdened with the cost of their care. That had made sense to me. The day Dr. Kimball lectured on slavery, he filled the overhead screen with a charcoal sketch of a slave market. The screen was large. As in a movie theater, it dominated the room. The sketch was chaotic. Women stood, naked or half-naked, and chained, while men circled them. The projector clacked. The next image was a photograph, black and white and blurred with age. Faded and overexposed, the image is iconic. In it, a man sits, stripped above the waist, exposing for the camera a map of raised, crisscrossing scars. The flesh hardly looks like flesh from what has been done to it. I saw many more images in the coming weeks. I'd heard of the Great Depression years before when I'd played Annie, but the slides of men in hats and long coats lined up in front of soup kitchens were new to me. When Dr. Kimball lectured on World War II, the screen showed rows of fighter planes interspersed with the skeletal remains of bombed cities. There were faces mixed in, FDR, Hitler, Stalin. Then World War II faded with the lights of the projector. The next time I entered the auditorium, there were new faces on the screen, and they were black. There hadn't been a black face on that screen, at least none that I remembered, since the lectures on slavery. I'd forgotten about them, these other Americans who were foreign to me. I had not tried to imagine the end of slavery. Surely the call of justice had been heard by all, and the issue had been resolved. This was my state of mind when Dr. Kimball began to lecture on something called the Civil Rights Movement. A date appeared on the screen, 1963. I figured there'd been a mistake. I recalled that the Emancipation Proclamation had been issued in 1863. I couldn't account for that 100 years, so I assumed it was a typo. I copied the date into my notes with a question mark, but as more photographs flashed across the screen, it became clear which century the professor meant. The photos were black and white, but their subjects were modern, vibrant, well-defined. They were not dry stills from another era. They captured movement, marches, police, firefighters turning hoses on young men. Dr. Kimball recited names I'd never heard. He began with Rosa Parks. An image appeared of a policeman pressing a woman's finger into an ink sponge. Dr. Kimball said she'd taken a seat on a bus. I understood him as saying she had stolen the seat, although it seemed an odd thing to steal. Her image was replaced by another, of a black boy in a white shirt, tie, and round-brimmed hat. I didn't hear his story. I was still wondering at Rosa Parks and how someone could steal a bus seat. Then the image was of a corpse, and I heard Dr. Kimball say, "They pulled his body from the river." There was a date beneath the image, 1955. I realized that Mother had been 4 years old in 1955, and with that realization, the distance between me and Emmett Till collapsed. My proximity to this murdered boy could be measured in the lives of people I knew. The calculation was not made with reference to vast historical or geological shifts, the fall of civilizations, the erosion of mountains. It was measured in the wrinkling of human flesh, in the lines on my mother's face. The next name was Martin Luther King Jr. I had never seen his face before, or heard his name, and it was several minutes before I understood that Dr. Kimball didn't mean Martin Luther, who I had heard of. It took several more minutes for me to connect the name with the image on the screen of a dark-skinned man standing in front of a white marble temple and surrounded by a vast crowd. I had only just understood who he was and why he was speaking when I was told he had been murdered. I was still ignorant enough to be surprised.
"Our nigger's back!"
I don't know what Sean saw on my face, whether it was shock, anger, or a vacant expression. Whatever it was, he was delighted by it. He'd found a vulnerability, a tender spot. It was too late to feign indifference. "Don't call me that," I said. "You don't know what it means."
"Sure I do," he said. "You've got black all over your face, like a nigger."
For the rest of the afternoon, for the rest of the summer, I was nigger. I'd answered to it 1,000 times before with indifference. If anything, I'd been amused and thought Sean was clever. Now it made me want to gag him, or sit him down with a history book, as long as it wasn't the one Dad still kept in the living room under the framed copy of the Constitution. I couldn't articulate how the name made me feel. Sean had meant it to humiliate me, to lock me in time, into an old idea of myself. But far from fixing me in place, that word transported me. Every time he said it,
"Hey, nigger, raise the boom," or "Fetch me a level, nigger,"
I returned to the university, to that auditorium where I had watched human history unfold and wondered at my place in it. The stories of Emmett Till, Rosa Parks, and Martin Luther King were called to my mind every time Sean shouted, "Nigger, move to the next row!" I saw their faces superimposed on every purlin Sean welded into place that summer, so that by the end of it, I had finally begun to grasp something that should have been immediately apparent. That someone had opposed the great march toward equality. Someone had been the person from whom freedom had to be wrested. I did not think of my brother as that person. I doubt I will ever think of him that way. But something had shifted nonetheless. I had started on a path of awareness, had perceived something elemental about my brother, my father, myself. I had discerned the ways in which we had been sculpted by a tradition given to us by others, a tradition of which we were either willfully or accidentally ignorant. I had begun to understand that we had lent our voices to a discourse whose sole purpose was to dehumanize and brutalize others, because nurturing that discourse was easier, because retaining power always feels like the way forward. I could not have articulated this, not as I sweated through those searing afternoons in the forklift. I did not have the language I have now, but I understood this one fact, that 1,000 times I had been called nigger and laughed, and now I could not laugh. The word and the way Sean said it hadn't changed, only my ears were different. They no longer heard the jingle of a joke in it. What they heard was a signal, a call through time, which was answered with a mounting conviction that I would never again be made a foot soldier in a conflict I did not understand. Chapter 21. Skullcap. Dad paid me the day before I returned to BYU. He didn't have the money to give what he'd promised, but it was enough to cover the half tuition I owed. I spent my last day in Idaho with Charles. It was a Sunday, but I didn't go to church. I'd had an earache for 2 days, and during the night it had changed from a dull twinge to a constant sharp stab. I had a fever. My vision was distorted, sensitive to light. That's when Charles called. Did I want to come to his house? I said I couldn't see well enough to drive. He picked me up 15 minutes later. I cupped my ear and slouched in the passenger seat, then took off my jacket and put it over my head to block the light. Charles asked what medicine I'd taken. Lobelia, I said, and Skullcap.
I don't think they're working, he said.
They will. They take a few days. He raised his eyebrows, but said nothing. Charles's house was neat and spacious, with large, bright windows and shiny floors. It reminded me of Grandma over in Town's house. I sat on a stool, my head pressed against the cold counter. I heard the creak of a cabinet opening and the pop of a plastic lid. When I opened my eyes, two red pills were on the counter in front of me.
This is what people take for pain, Charles said.
Not us.
Who is this us? Charles said. You're leaving tomorrow. You're not one of them anymore.
I closed my eyes, hoping he would drop it.
What do you think will happen if you take the pills? He said.
I didn't answer. I didn't know what would happen. Mother always said that medical drugs are a special kind of poison, one that never leaves your body but rots you slowly from the inside for the rest of your life. She told me if I took a drug now, even if I didn't have children for a decade, they would be deformed.
People take drugs for pain, he said. It's normal.
I must have winced at the word normal because he went quiet. He filled a glass of water and set it in front of me, then gently pushed the pills forward until they touched my arm. I picked one up. I'd never seen a pill up close before. It was smaller than I'd expected. I swallowed it, then the other. For as long as I could remember, whenever I was in pain, whether from a cut or a toothache, Mother would make a tincture of lobelia and Skullcap. It had never lessened the pain, not one degree. Because of this, I had come to respect pain, even revere it, as necessary and untouchable. 20 minutes after I swallowed the red pills, the earache was gone. I couldn't comprehend its absence. I spent the afternoon swinging my head from left to right, trying to jog the pain loose again. I thought if I could shout loudly enough or move quickly enough, perhaps the earache would return, and I would know the medicine had been a sham after all. Charles watched in silence, but he must have found my behavior absurd, especially when I began to pull on my ear, which still ached dully, so I could test the limits of this strange witchcraft. Mother was supposed to drive me to BYU the next morning, but during the night, she was called to deliver a baby. There was a car sitting in the driveway, a Kia Sophia Dad had bought from Tony a few weeks before. The keys were in the ignition. I loaded my stuff into it and drove it to Utah, figuring the car would just about make up for the money Dad owed me. I guess he figured that too, because he never said a word about it. I moved into an apartment half a mile from the university. I had new roommates. Robin was tall and athletic, and the first time I saw her, she was wearing running shorts that were much too short, but I didn't gape at her. When I met Jenny, she was drinking a Diet Coke. I didn't stare at that either, because I'd seen Charles drink dozens of them. Robin was the oldest, and for some reason she was sympathetic to me. Somehow she understood that my missteps came from ignorance, not intention, and she corrected me gently but frankly. She told me exactly what I would need to do or not do to get along with the other girls in the apartment. No keeping rotten food in the cupboards or leaving rancid dishes in the sink. Robin explained this at an apartment meeting. When she'd finished, another roommate, Megan, cleared her throat. I'd like to remind everyone to wash their hands after they use the bathroom, she said, and not just with water, but with soap. Robin rolled her eyes. I'm sure everyone here washes their hands. That night, after I left the bathroom, I stopped at the sink in the hall and washed my hands. With soap. The next day was the first day of class. Charles had designed my course schedule, He'd signed me up for 2 music classes and a course on religion, all of which he said would be easy for me. Then he'd enrolled me in 2 more challenging courses, college algebra, which terrified me, and biology, which didn't, but only because I didn't know what it was. Algebra threatened to put an end to my scholarship. The professor spent every lecture muttering inaudibly as he paced in front of the chalkboard. I wasn't the only one who was lost, but I was more lost than anyone else. Charles tried to help, but he was starting his senior year of high school and had his own schoolwork. In October, I took the midterm and failed it. I stopped sleeping. I stayed up late, twisting my hair into knots as I tried to wrest meaning from the textbook, then lying in bed and brooding over my notes. I developed stomach ulcers. Once, Jenny found me curled up on a stranger's lawn, halfway between campus and our apartment. My stomach was on fire. I was shaking with the pain, but I wouldn't let her take me to a hospital. She sat with me for half an hour, then walked me home. The pain in my stomach intensified, burning through the night, making it impossible to sleep. I needed money for rent, so I got a job as a janitor for the engineering building. My shift began every morning at 4. Between the ulcers and the janitorial work, I barely slept. Jenny and Robin kept saying I should see a doctor, but I didn't. I told them I was going home for Thanksgiving and that my mother would cure me. They exchanged nervous glances, but didn't say anything. Charles said my behavior was self-destructive, that I had an almost pathological inability to ask for help. He told me this on the phone, and he said it so quietly it was almost a whisper. I told him he was crazy. "Then go talk to your algebra professor," he said. "You're failing. Ask for help." It had never occurred to me to talk to a professor. I didn't realize we were allowed to talk to them, so I decided to try, if only to prove to Charles I could do it. I knocked on his office door a few days before Thanksgiving. He looked smaller in his office than he did in the lecture hall, and more shiny. The light above his desk reflected off his head and glasses. He was shuffling through the papers on his desk, and he didn't look up when I sat down. "If I fail this class," I said, "I'll lose my scholarship." I didn't explain that without a scholarship, I couldn't come back. "I'm sorry," he said, barely looking at me, "but this is a tough school. It might be better if you come back when you're older, or transfer." I didn't know what he meant by transfer, so I said nothing. I stood to go, and for some reason, this softened him. "Truthfully," he said, "a lot of people are failing." He sat back in his chair. "How about this? The final covers all the material from the semester. I'll announce in class that anyone who gets a perfect score on the final, not a 98, but an actual 100, will get an A, no matter how they performed on the midterm. Sound good?" I said it did. It was a long shot, but I was the queen of long shots. I called Charles. I told him I was coming to Idaho for Thanksgiving, and I needed an algebra tutor. He said he would meet me at Buck's Peak. Chapter 22. What We Whispered and What We Screamed. When I arrived at the peak, Mother was making the Thanksgiving meal. The large oak table was covered with jars of tincture and vials of essential oil, which I cleared away. Charles was coming for dinner. Sean was in a mood. He sat on a bench at the table, watching me gather the bottles and hide them. I'd washed Mother's china, which had never been used, and I began laying it out, eyeing the distance between each plate and knife. Sean resented my making a fuss.
"It's just Charles," he said. "His standards aren't that high. He's with you, after all."
I fetched glasses. When I put one in front of him, Sean jabbed a finger into my ribs, digging hard. "Don't touch me!" I shrieked. Then the room turned upside down. My feet were knocked out from under me, and I was swept into the living room, just out of Mother's sight. Sean turned me onto my back and sat on my stomach, pinning my arms at my sides with his knees. The shock of his weight forced the breath from my chest. He pressed his forearm into my windpipe. I sputtered, trying to gulp